No bottom yet for housing.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. It's hard to believe, but we're approaching 2 years of falling home prices, at least according to the Case-Shiller Housing Index. We got the latest index this morning for May. Prices fell 16% compared to a year ago. And for the second straight month, not one of the 20 cities saw prices increase. The overall index has not had an increase since August of 2006. The biggest drops came in Las Vegas and Miami, 28% each. The bank losses aren't going away either. More red ink from Merrill Lynch this morning. But the bank does have a plan to get rid of its toxic assets. Sell $30 billion worth at just 22 cents on the dollar. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
In addition to its fire sale of debt, Merrill will also take a $5.7 billion write-down in the third quarter. The company says it's tied to additional losses on the sale of, what else, mortgage securities. According to mortgage banking consulting firm Wholesale Access, banks have already written off about $450 billion in bad mortgage debts. That sounds like a lot, but the firm's managing director, Tom LaMalfa, says we're only halfway through a $1 trillion subprime mortgage crisis.
Because that's the amount of non-prime mortgages that have been written since 2005. And since we think there's a reversal going on in property values, there has been the disappearance of all that equity.
LaMalfa is not sure government regulators can do much to stem the ongoing losses. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Merrill Lynch's stock fell 11% yesterday. The Dow dropped 240 points, about 2%. So maybe Wall Street will get a bounce today. So far, a little bit of gain. The Dow is up 43 points to 11,174. The NASDAQ has added 18, and the S&P 500 is up 4 points. In Asia today, the markets closed 1 to 2% lower. European shares are mixed so far. The dollar gained some value, so oil is down another couple bucks to $123 a barrel. What do you get when you cross a French company with an American one? Well, in this case, a disaster. Alcatel-Lucent has had 6 quarterly losses in a row. And today, the company said CEO Pat Russo will be leaving in October. You might remember when she came to Paris a couple years ago with the merger, she had a little too much American bravado for French tastes. Our European correspondent Stephen Beard has more.
The marriage between Paris-based Alcatel and Lucent Technologies of New Jersey has not been a happy one. Since they joined forces, the share price has fallen 50%. Matt Hatton is with the telecom research group analyst Mason.
The nitty-gritty of stitching these two companies together has proved to be more than they were anticipating, and they haven't really managed to exploit the economies of scale that were presented by such a mega merger.
Meanwhile, the market for fixed-line telecom equipment has been difficult with fierce competition from the Chinese. Today, investors welcomed the departure of Alcatel-Lucent's chairman and chief executive. The share price rose 6% on the news. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Speaking of mergers, Sirius and XM said this morning they have completed their deal. The new company will be called Sirius XM Radio, and it will be the second largest radio company with 18 million subscribers. No changes in price or programming that we know of yet. The company's stock will be traded on NASDAQ. This is the Morning Report for Tuesday, July 29th on Marketplace.org. As you know, the government's been stepping in to help out the banks, Fannie and Freddie, homeowners, and to stabilize the financial markets. Last week, regulators put in temporary restrictions on short selling, but those restrictions expire at midnight tonight. More now from Bob Moon.
Short sellers borrow stock and then sell it. Then if the price falls before they have to return it, they can pocket the difference. It's called naked short selling when just the promise that shares will be borrowed is enough to carry out a trade. Since last week, short selling of 19 major financial stocks can't happen until traders prove the borrowed shares they're selling are essentially in hand. SEC Chairman Christopher Cox argued that should help keep abusive short selling from driving down prices. But it hasn't stopped some shares from sinking steadily ever since.
And if you look at the stock price of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac over the last 3 days, they're down, what, 30%?
John Standerfer is with the research firm S3 Matching Technologies. He says the extra paperwork is costly and time-consuming for smaller traders, but not the big guys.
This rule has created a lot of problems for retail investors. The larger players, you know, are much less encumbered by it.
Otherwise, he says the rule has little effect. Before it was imposed, short-selling trades he tracked involving those particular stocks totaled just 1%. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We've talked a lot about solar energy and wind energy and how lots of money is pouring into those oil and coal alternatives. The kinds of industries making those investments is pretty wide-ranging. Take the computer business, for example. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
In the last few months, Intel, IBM, and National Semiconductor have announced major investments and technological breakthroughs in solar panels. That doesn't surprise Silicon Valley analyst Rob Enderle. He says many computer companies already work with silicon, the main ingredient in both computer chips and solar panels. But similarities aside, Enderle says money is the main driver of the union.
It's seen as a way to kind of restore the microprocessor market or the chip market into something that's even more powerful and more robust than it was in its heyday in the late 90s.
Today, growth in the computer chip business has slowed, but solar power is projected to grow 40% annually. And as companies like IBM and National Semiconductor begin to mass produce solar panels and their components, analysts say solar power could soon beat out coal on price. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
With food prices where they are, a lot of people have been talking about eating local, as in locally grown food. We wondered if that means more people are getting into farming. You might be surprised what we found in New Jersey. Matt Hackworth tells the story.
Jeff Tober didn't grow up on a farm, but he's happiest doing farm chores, like washing out vegetable bins. He was hooked on agriculture even as a kid in the suburbs.
Seeing a potato growing in our compost pile, I think something really clicked, like, wow.
Tober learned how to farm by working for organic growers, but he couldn't imagine getting a farm of his own. With the cost of equipment and land, you'd almost have to be a millionaire, like on Green Acres, to buy a farm. But New Jersey's Farm Bureau says there's an influx of first-generation farmers. The state's agriculture secretary says the average New Jersey farmer is 55, but he's expecting the age to get younger as newcomers begin to farm. One reason is the Garden State aggressively protects more than 164,000 acres from development, and there are plenty of landowners like Larry Kuser who would like to see their land farmed by someone else. Kuser hired Jeff Tober to work his land.
Jeff is a wonderful farmer. I don't know anything about growing vegetables. I knew I couldn't do this myself. I needed somebody who knew what they were doing. He's fantastic.
On a hot Saturday morning, customers cart away bags from the farm store Kuser and Tober opened, full of greens and strawberries so fresh they show a trace of dirt from the field just outside. Subdivisions surround Kuser's farm, driving up the price of the land. But Tober says it also puts customers right at his fingertips.
When you're looking for a farm, two of the big questions you ask are, what are my soils and what's my market? And I think New Jersey offers very good soils in general, the Garden State, and the most densely populated state in the country, so access to very good markets.
In their second year, Kuser and Tober have dozens of families who have bought a share in their business in exchange for fresh fruits and vegetables. Now, 2 years into their community-supported agriculture partnership, Kuser and Tober hope to turn a profit next year. In Bordentown, New Jersey, I'm Matt Hackworth for Marketplace.
Last year, there were some splashy IPOs on Wall Street from Chinese companies. But this year, only two companies have gone public and listed their stock in the U.S. That's so far But there will be two more Chinese companies this week. Lisa Chow has more from Beijing.
The current environment for initial public offerings on both sides of the ocean is less than ideal. The U.S. stock market has seen little IPO activity this year from any company, foreign or domestic. And Chinese companies have been grappling with their own pressures. Donald Strossheim is a China watcher for Roth Capital Partners in Los Angeles.
What I think most investors believe is that China's economy is going to be slowing, Olympics or no Olympics, and inflation remains pretty high. And that's pretty stiff current to run against when you're trying to do IPOs of companies in an economy like that.
Of the two Chinese IPOs coming to market this week, one is in online education, which is proving to be a huge growth business in China. The other company is a television advertising firm, which is more exposed to blips in the economy. Each company hopes to raise at least $75 million on the New York Stock Exchange. In Beijing, I'm Lisa Chow for Marketplace.
The Beijing Summer Olympics are just 10 days away. For some American companies, this is the marketing opportunity of a lifetime. The Olympics, plus a host country of 1.3 billion people. But selling to China is by no means a no-brainer. Recent history is filled with stories of American failures in the Chinese market. Our reporter in Shanghai, Scott Tong, has a few lessons.
Lesson number one in what not to do in China? Build it the American way and assume they will come. China Market Research founder Sean Ryan says take eBay. He says it assumed incorrectly a big hand-me-down market in China.
There's an aversion in China to buying used products. People think, you know, old is old. It's not antique. They don't think it's a good deal. It means that you're poor.
The key in consultant speak is to localize, make your product relevant. Ryan thinks the world's top brands don't do it very well.
They were so successful in their home markets, and they know the secret sauce in America, but they're not willing to change. You know, Walmart, Google, McDonald's.
All right, Sean, just cross off those potential clients from your list. Anyway, back to localization.
On the other hand, you can take it too far.
Here's Paul French of the consultancy Access Asia.
The Kit Kat brand of chocolate did a watermelon-flavored Kit Kat. Chinese people, although they love watermelon, decided that watermelon-flavored chocolate was actually a pretty disgusting combination, and so they rejected that.
French says multinationals have also tripped over themselves, figuring out how much to charge. If you go bargain basement, you're dead.
Don't get into a fight with the Chinese on price, because you cannot win. General Electric, when they first came into China, tried to sell light bulbs. Why on earth would you try and compete with the Chinese on light bulbs? Chinese can own the light bulb market. It's generic, it's non-branded, it's cheap as chips.
And then there's timing. When to land in China. Come too late and the market's already saturated. But John Chen of China Street Smart says don't come too early either. You might want to let the competition move in first and botch things on their dime.
If you take German beers and Dutch beers and Japanese beers, a lot of them tend to be a little heavier. Now, a lot of them figured out 5 to 6 years into it that Chinese generally like lighter tasting beers.
Enter lighter tasting Budweiser, which he says hopped in, if you will, at the right time. In general, Chen thinks the major multinationals committed the biggest errors all the way back in the 90s. In other words, they've cleared the hazardous minefield for the new entrants, at least those smart enough to watch where they step. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great day.
American Public Media.